Welcome to the latest episode of season 4 of the Digital Adoption Show, your go-to podcast for cutting-edge insights and innovative strategies in today's dynamic work environment. I am your host for the episode, Pavitra R, an information developer at WhatFix. Today, we are really excited to explore some emerging trends in the instructional design space. I think we couldn't have found a better guest for this episode. Drum rolls, please. It's the accidental instructional designer herself, Cami Bean. I think most of our audience will be familiar with Cami, but if you're not, let me introduce you to her. Cami is the world-renowned author of the most acclaimed book in the L&D space, The Accidental Instructional Designer, Learning Design for the Digital Age, that was originally published in 2014 and updated in 2020. Cami started in the industry as a junior instructional designer in 96, long before it was even called e-learning, and has since collaborated with hundreds of organizations to design and deliver training programs. She's worked at small startups, mid-sized training companies, boutique e-learning shops, and as a freelance instructional designer. With a college major in English and German studies, Cami found an affinity to writing and making complex ideas simple and clear for her audience. In 2009, she played a pivotal role in establishing the US operations for Kinio, a global provider of learning solutions. Originally serving as Kinio's VP of Learning Design, Cami is currently a senior solutions consultant. In this role, she leads the North American sales team, supports clients through the initial discovery phase, manages Kinio's portfolio of custom clients accounts to help organizations meet their strategic business objectives through better learning solutions. Kinio is a global organization specializing in e-learning solutions. I am delighted to have you on the podcast today, Cami. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. That was quite an intro. I'm blushing.
Yeah. So before we get into the serious topics, I think our audience should get to know a little bit of Cami, the person behind the instructional designer. So I have a small question for you in this session called The Digital Pulse. So my question is, what is that one passion or activity that you have outside of work that actually brings you a lot of joy?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with digital, right? As you said that, the digital pulse is like anti-digital. I live right up against woods. I live in New England in Massachusetts, and my favorite thing is just out in the woods walking with my dog, whatever that will be. So that's it. Off the grid.
Oh my God, that's so sweet. Do you go on hikes like every weekend?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much every morning I can just walk out the door and we can go in the woods or and go on the weekend exploring, checking out the places where people don't go. We like to go into wild woods where there aren't people around. So that's my favorite.
That sounds pretty fun. So next we have this session that I think everybody has, a quick rapid fire round that I'm going to call Candid with Cami. So Cami, please feel free to be as candid as possible. And we've tried to make the questions very quirky. So the first question is, if you had a warning label, what would it say?
Oh, it would say often running late. I'm notoriously 2 minutes late for a meeting or 5 minutes late dropping my kids off or something. I'm just always trying to pack so much in and I get lost in what I'm doing. Often running late.
Okay. And if you could have any mythical creature as your pet, what would it be?
Oh, well, let's see. I was a child of the 1980s and unicorns were very big. I had unicorn posters all over my room, which is a funny thing now to think about. I'm not really a horse person, so I don't think today I would choose a unicorn as my mythical creature. I'd go with a dragon, something fierce and protective that can blow fire. It seems very exciting.
Yeah, that's a very nice mythical creature to have. I mean, very handy, you know, to fly to places.
Yeah, right. You could fly around. You could, I don't know, scorch your enemies. Not that I have any, but, you know, be very, yes.
Move over, Daenerys. It's us next.
There you go. Yes.
Yeah. If you had to wear one outfit for the rest of your life, what would that be?
Gosh, this is a hard one. I live in New England. We have four seasons. There's not one outfit that you could choose, but whatever I chose, it would be something extremely comfortable. So okay. I could take what I'm wearing right now. It's comfortable. It looks all right.
So I'm done with all the fun questions. So let's get into the serious topic for the day.
No more fun.
Yes, we are going to be very focused. Okay. So my first question is, you have a bachelor's degree in English and German studies, and you started off doing odd jobs at a company that helped employees balance work and family issues. So if you could tell our audience, how did you get started with instructional designing and what led you to become the accidental instructional designer that you keep calling yourself?
That is what I call myself. I think, like many people, I did not set out to be get involved in adult corporate training, right? That was not even on my radar. I did think I was going to go maybe become a college teacher or professor. So I had teaching in my mind, but I started working at this company. It was called Work Family Directions, and it was 1992. We were putting our processes on computers. This was like early stage computers, and nobody knew how to use them. We had never really interacted with computers. So we were designing a call center program so that our phone counselors could take what had previously just been paper. They had boxes of folders and paperwork on all of the people that they talked to, and we're putting that onto a computer system. It was, super revolutionary at the time. And I just got involved. Somehow I had the right skills and capacity to be that intermediary between the IT nerds who were building the program and the end user who were using it. So I started being able to translate needs to the technical audience, and through that just helped design the system. So my roots, similar to what Fix, right, are really about software training. So that's where I got started. Well, it was software development. And then as the system went live, it sort of naturally fell to me to train the system because I knew it so well. I'd helped design it. And I could stand in front of a group of people and, entertain them. And I could write newsletters and job aids and tip sheets. I had the writing background. I think communication was so strong and all of those skills that you do. So it was a natural move towards that training role. And then I had an opportunity. I knew, a friend of a friend who had a master's degree in educational technology from Harvard. I live in Massachusetts area, so we have access to great universities here. And she was working at a company called Video Information Systems, VIS, and they had an opportunity for a junior instructional design role. It was sounded really sexy and glamorous. We were do, you know, I've creating CD-ROM training programs and doing video shoots in a studio and writing scripts. It sounded really, really cool and creative. And I was ready to move on. I'd been at Work Family for about 5 years, and it was time for that next opportunity. And it just seemed kind of the perfect fit. I had never heard of instructional design as a field or an area. And it was as if I had just been magically tapped by, the fairy of good fortune that said, and here is your next role and your next opportunity. And here I am, almost 30 years later, still in this same industry. So super fortunate that I fell accidentally into it, have not had any formal training along the way. And I think that's, unusual at this stage. A lot of people, well, but not a lot of people fall into the field by accident. I, about 10 years into it, I had been working for 10 years, and I started reading my first instructional design books. Like I pulled out, what are the academic books that people are reading? And I started understanding learning theory in a way that I hadn't before, because I was just doing what other people told me to do, right? Like, we're going to show me, try me, test me, follow the models that other people shared with me. So it was only 10 years in that I decided to get more intentional about my practice and start to learn in a more formal way, but I still did it informally. So that's a bit of my story and my journey into this. And then I've had worn many hats along the way, as one does in instructional design.
Okay, so I think this will be a very interesting question for you to answer. So when you were an instructional designer, so what would your typical day look like?
When I was an instructional designer, right? So yeah, the secret is my career has evolved and I'm now doing sales mostly, but instructional design still plays a very heavy role in my day-to-day work. I still think like an instructional designer. But back in the day when I was doing instructional design, it kind of depends on the company that I was working at. I was at a small boutique e-learning shop where I was gathering content. I was working with the sales team. I was writing scripts. I was doing QA. I was the project manager. All the hats that you have to wear especially when you're in a smaller e-learning operation. And I've always been on the vendor side of the business since 1996. So my role is probably a little bit different than those who are working internally to organizations. And then when I came to Kineo, it was a little different because we had specific people who are working as project managers. We specialized a lot more. So I only had to focus on the instructional design piece. I have written probably 1,000 e-learning scripts in the time, maybe not 1,000. That may be a little hyperbole, but I wrote a lot of scripts, a lot of content meetings with clients, a lot of mapping things on boards with sticky notes, a lot of testing, a lot of collaboration. It's always working with our production team, our graphic designers to create an experience and then working really closely with the client to make sure we're executing on their vision. So, you know, it's a very people-focused role for the most part in my expression of instructional design.
That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And everybody looks a little different, right? I think Pavita, you'd shared that you're a technical writer.
Yes.
Do you may or may not interface with clients and people?
I don't interact with clients directly because I come under the product field. So we have product managers who do it for us. So we are mostly in touch only with product managers.
Yeah. Yeah. So your audience may be a little different than mine. And I think that's one of the great things about instructional design, and I'm characterizing that broadly. I often include training technical writers in that because you're creating instructional materials and you need to bring instructional design skills to that. But we all express our instructional design in different ways, and the same job title at one company may look very different at another company.
True. We also make a lot of videos. So we make a lot of instructional videos. We try to amp it up with a lot of graphics. How can we pull the audience to look at our content? Yeah, so we also do a lot of videos and stuff. Makes sense. So you launched the second edition of your book last year. And how would you say the second edition is different from the first? And what are some of the changes that you've observed in the instructional design space over the last couple of years?
Oh, yeah, so many. So I first published the book in 2014, and then this edition came out in 2023. So the biggest difference is I have 10 more years of experience in the industry, and I've seen more. I know more. I know more things at this point. I think that many people land in instructional design, and it's kind of like the parable of the blind man meeting an elephant, right? So I land on instructional design, and I, at my company, I'm speaking hypothetically right now, somebody says, you're good at communicating, or you know this content area really well. Why don't you learn Sturt and build out great courses? And for that person, instructional design is building out something in an e-learning course. They're the blind person touching just the trunk of the elephant. And somebody else might come into it from a different angle. They're the LMS administrator, but they're called an instructional designer, or they have different set of tasks in their job function or their quiver of tools that they're doing. And so everyone has kind of, we all come into ID with a different understanding and a different perspective. And I think my experience over the last almost 30 years now is I keep getting a broader and broader view of the elephant. Like I touch more parts of it over time, so I have more insight and understanding. And I would say a lot of that is getting expressed in the book, because it's a bit less about the specific tactics of creating a great e-learning experience and trying to help people ground in the larger field that is L&D. There's so much opportunity and possibility in learning and development and training. And if you know, my hope is that if you're coming new to this industry and you're getting a job as an instructional designer, that early on you can get that bigger view, because then you can start to see all the possibilities and where you can go. And you can ultimately have more value to the business when you better understand the bigger picture that is training and development, rather than just, I build courses and storyline. So I think I've injected a lot of that into the book. And, you know, and truly, how has the ID landscape changed over the years? In many ways, we could probably talk about that for an hour. Here in the US, what we've seen in the market is, coming out of the pandemic, a lot of former teachers are moving into instructional design because they wanted to get out of the classroom and teaching elementary education and things like that. So we see a lot of people who have these great skills, you know, for teaching and want to pivot into instructional design. So a lot of people maybe mid-career making a change. So that's a big change too. And then, of course, the technology. And that's the bit that we could talk about for hours. There's always something new going on, new shiny objects, and, you know, today the big thing is AI, right? Like, how is that going to change what we do? And everyone has fear and concern about my job going away. I'm here to say now we still have a place. Don't worry, people.
That's very reassuring. So I think the next question would be very helpful for a lot of emerging instructional designer. You said that it is better if they know the bigger picture before they get in, right? And my question to you is, what are some of the critical skills and knowledge areas that they should specialize in before actually getting into the field?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to tell you what anyone should do because, again, this is such a wide, varied field. I will put it in the framework of a pie. So I talk about this in the book, but really thinking about the core skills and areas that we need to master, not necessarily master at first, but to have some awareness of and knowledge. So one is learning and pedagogy, understanding how people learn. This is, you know, adults, how adults learn, how to define a right instructional strategy, curriculum design, assessments, writing. You know, this is learning science stuff. And that could be, you could get a PhD in learning science, and that could be your sweet spot. That could be your area of focus. However, with training, that's not the only thing. We also have to think about the creative element. I mean, you talked about this just with software stuff. Like, are we going to put pictures? How are we going to engage people? How are we going to tell stories? How are we going to ensure that the content is truly relevant and meaningful to people? It's not just a list of Bloom's taxonomy instructional objectives that we're trying to force down people. We want it to hook them and engage them. And that is often through the more creative elements. Visual design, really important in digital learning, making sure it's on brand, looks good, because that creates credibility for an experience. If you're doing game design or video production or audio production, those are all skills that you could master. The third piece of the pie is the technology piece, which really could be huge. That could be understanding an LMS, it's SCORM, it's QA testing, it's XAPI, if that's your thing. It's all the business technologies that go into creating digital learning or supporting classroom learning too. You know, nothing is without digital these days. That's just a factor of our life. So you could go really deep into the technology piece of the pie. The fourth piece of the pie is about business skills. So being a consultant, working with your parts of the business, understanding the business objectives, you might have to be a project manager. You might have to manage a project on time and on budget, performance consulting skills. It goes on and on, right? It's a huge, there are so many skills in all of this. So what I encourage people is to understand that big picture. This is the elephant. So understanding the elephant or the pie, all those pieces that are out there, you might have a sweet spot that really pulls you in that you want to focus on. That's super important. For me, it was writing. That's what pulled me into the field and finding that creative element. And, you know, I still hold on to that very strongly. Over the last 30 years, though, I've broadened and I've started learning more about this whole pie. So I think, you know, I'm 30 years into this. I have a lot of knowledge and experience. So find what your sweet spot is, develop that skill, hone that skill, but also get to know the bigger picture. Don't feel like you have to be an expert in all of those things, though, because you can't. It's too many skills. It's too much, right? So yeah, find your sweet spot, understand what your weaknesses are, explore those, grow in those areas, and, you know, find your path forward, because there are many paths in this space.
Okay. Would you call yourself an expert, though, in all the pie?
No, God, no. I mean, for years, like the technology piece of the pie, I honestly stuck my fingers in my ears and I was like, I don't want to know about an LMS. I don't want to understand what that is. I don't want to know about SCORM, really. I'll let my technical people deal with that. And then I started selling an LMS and I had to take my fingers out of my ears and really start to pay attention and understand that technical piece much more than I had ever wanted to. So you're going to find your blind spots. So I think over time I've realized I've had to learn more about that. And as we get into, you know, XAPI or data and analytics or AI, right? All these technology tools that get added into the mix. Don't feel like you have to be an expert in all of these areas, because that's not possible. It's just too much. But if you're working on a team, you might look at who is on your team, and for training managers out there who are high net development team, ensure that you have a broad representation of skills from all areas of the pie so that you can have that more holistic view. You've got people who can do the consulting, you've got people who can do that creative aspect to understand the technology, who've got the learning sciences. So it doesn't have to always be on one person's head. I do think it's important for an individual working in this space, though, to have that broad view, at least to know what's out there. You can you can become a generalist and know a lot about a little, right? That's okay too, but have your deeper areas of expertise as well.
So I'm going to get into the technical stuff a little bit. So one of the prominent trends in ID right now is personalized learning pathways. So how
Yep.
important do you think personalized learning pathways can improve learning, and what's an effective way to implement them?
Oh, that might be above my pay grade. But I do think people, it's really important. People are time poor. We're busy. We're easily distracted. Nobody really wants to take your, 30-minute e-learning course if they can help it, right? A lot of people think this stuff is really boring. So ensuring that we're designing effective experiences, that we're designing experiences that are relevant to the adult learner and are going to be useful to them at that moment of need is really essential. We don't want to waste people's time. And I think personalized learning pathways can be a really effective way to do that. So you can, have an LMS or some kind of an algorithm on the back end that's mapping skills to what people need to learn and know and make those recommendations. This is where you may need a team of people who understand the broader technical stuff. It's not something that one person can implement for sure. And ultimately, if what we're feeding people is relevant to their job so that they can perform and develop their own careers better and build the skills that they need to, then people will be happy to consume the content that's out there.
We try to make our videos less than 3 minutes because I don't think people can focus anywhere beyond 3 minutes.
People can focus anywhere beyond 3 minutes, right? You can sit down and watch a 3-hour movie if it's really good, right? We do have that ability to focus. But when we're on the job and working, I don't know. Yeah, I ain't got time for training. I just need to do my job. Yeah. So how are we going to ensure that people have the tools that they need to perform successfully? And that's truly, that's the challenge.
Yeah. And in your previous question, you mentioned data, right? Integrating data with learning. So how have you successfully integrated data and learning analytics into your daily work? And has that changed the game for you?
Yeah, I think as an industry, it certainly changed the game for us. So really understanding what is the impact that we're trying to have with a learning experience? What is it that we're trying to measure? How are we going to show success? How do we know that we've moved the needle on performance? A lot of that's going to be tying back to business metrics and demonstrating the value. It's often can be hard to make those correlations. At Kineo, one of the things that we're doing is trying to help instructional designers and learning design teams get more out of the content experiences we've created. So we've actually created an add-on to one of our product suites called Kineo Analytics, actually to two of our product suites. And we are baking that in, trying to make it easier to understand how people are engaging with your content experience. So we know that SCORM and traditional LMS data is really flat. We can tell course completions and that's about it. That's on one side of the spectrum. And SCORM, I remember when SCORM came onto the market in the early 2000s, it's still the standard all these years later, and it's still not very good. XAPI came onto the scene, and XAPI, the promises of XAPI is you can collect anything, you can collect everything, but you need another system, you need a learning record store. It seems really complicated. And the truth is people just really aren't adopting XAPI and the numbers that were hoped for because it just feels too hard, feels too complicated. So Kineo, we're trying to kind of circumvent that and bake it into our solutions. And I think a lot of organizations are trying to do that too, right? So you can then have dashboards that people can look at without having to set up all these custom XAPI statements and things like that. So one of our core value propositions is data. It's getting more. It's what are we measuring and how are we demonstrating that impact? So I don't think we're alone in that.
Okay. So we spoke about collecting data. So what would you consider a success metric for a good learning program? And what are some of the metrics that you have considered?
Yeah, I mean, every learning solution is going to have a different set of metrics. It may or may not be, it shouldn't be completion, right? It should actually tie back to business results. If you're trying to improve customer service, is it your NPS score that actually goes up? And then how do you demonstrate that correlation? So understanding at the beginning of every learning engagement that you're trying, what is it that we're trying to measure? What does success look like? You have to work with your stakeholders really clearly on that and try to map that out. So there's not one answer for that, but it's really important to ensure that you are asking those questions during the design phase.
So I think we are going back to the pie question. So how do you forecast a pie? So what are your thoughts on emerging technologies? So what do you think will happen next, and what does the future look like for instructional designers?
Staring into my crystal ball. Well, right now, everyone's kind of dealing with the wave of AI and how disruptive that is. What is that going to do to my job? How is that going to change my workflow? Seeing a lot of data about AI and where it is getting integrated into workflows right now really is a way to speed up content development and reduce costs. The risk, of course, is that we're going to create more garbage more quickly and just inundate people with content because we can do it so fast. This was something that happened about 2000 was when some of the first authoring tools came on the market. And I had been in this field already for 10 years at that point, and we were dying for these tools. We were dying for templated tools that would speed up content production. And that was really disruptive to the market, though, because now anyone could create e-learning. You didn't need to go to a custom content development company and have something hand programmed and, cost thousands and thousands of dollars. People could do it themselves. So at Kineo, we were really focused. That was when we got started, and our focus was on helping organizations do better design with these tools, because what matters is great instructional design. What matters is keeping the human being at the heart of the solution that you're designing. And that same thing is happening today, I think. We have AI as the big disruptor. So it's going to be baked into all of our authoring tools, right? So you're going to be able to create even more content more quickly, which sounds awesome, but there's a danger with that. And so the core skills of instructional design, ensuring that we are designing thoughtfully for human beings, making sure we're having the right impact, that does not go away. So emerging technologies, there's always something emerging. And if we keep our focus on what really matters, which is human beings, people, my mantra is it's all about the people, man. Keep human beings at the center of it. Then we will ensure that we are, collaborating well with AI as we go forward. I do think there's three key areas that I've been kind of focusing on and trying to upskill myself on, which is really AI skills. If you see it, there's a lot of conversation in the market about skills development and skills tools and skills technology. So how is that going to shift what we're doing? And then, of course, data and analytics and that measurement piece. So keep your eye on those areas, keep growing and learning with them, have the appropriate amount of skepticism too. I mean, 10 years ago, everything was about mobile learning and everything had to be on your mobile device. And we had to really make sure that everything was going to, because this vision that people were going to be sitting on a subway taking their e-learning on their way to work. And you know what? Nobody's doing that. If they're on the subway, they're looking at Instagram. They are not taking your e-learning. The data is now showing us that we build mobile-first solutions. And it's, 5% of the audience is taking them on a mobile device. Most people are still sitting down at their desktop. So be careful of these emerging technologies. Have the appropriate amount of skepticism, but also don't let it pass you by. Don't be left in the dust either. So it's really important to pay attention and be upskilling as you go.
Makes sense. And I think next we can have e-learning on Reels. We will never know. Yeah. Okay. I'm done with my questions, Cami. So it was very interesting and a lot of fun to talk to you. So before we go to our listeners, please tune in to the Digital Adoption Show across platforms to listen to more such interesting, fun, and intriguing conversations with some of the top minds of the digital space. We are available on Apple, YouTube, and Google. So whether you're at home or on the go, don't miss out on our latest episodes. It was wonderful talking to you, Cami. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And it was a wonderful episode. And we wish you the best. And I am your host, Pavitra, signing off.
All right. Thank you all. Thanks
Thank
for having me.
you.